So, this is, as you will understand from that introduction, ongoing work in discussion with Neil Turek, who's also at Perimeter. It will be borrowing heavily ideas from two recent papers by Ed Witten about a new way of choosing the contour over which to perform the Feynman path integral, and basically asking whether those can be of use in fixing some of the shortcomings of a proposal for the wave function, the famous proposal for the wave function in the universe from Hartle and Hawking. Okay, so maybe to start by way of introduction. So here is the zeta function, the Riemann zeta function. The zeta of s is defined by the sum. You've probably all seen it before. The key feature that I want to mention is, so the sum only converges. So here we have a plot of this function, some attempt to visualize this function in the complex S plane. And the sum only converges for the real part of S greater than 1, so more or less in the red half of the figure. But the values of the function in that region, are enough to analytically uniquely continue it to an analytic function over the rest of the complex plane. And the key point is that the region in which the sum converges, the defining sum converges, is different than the region that we're most interested in studying. The region that we're now most interested in studying is this famous line, real part of S is equal to 1/2, where for reasons that are still not clear or proven, all the non-trivial zeros of the function appear to lie. So my point of mentioning this is just that the situation with the Riemann zeta function is, in this sense, rather similar to the situation with the Feynman path integral. So here's the Feynman path integral that you're supposed to evaluate for a simple for the quantum field theory of a single scalar field phi, and it's sort of similar that the region where you want to study it, over the region where you want to study it, the function is highly oscillatory. In the analogy here, everything inside the curly brackets, or let's say exponential of everything inside the curly brackets, is the analog of 1 over n to the s. So we for every field configuration, we get a number. And then the path integral over d phi, the path integral over all configurations, is the analog of the sum from n equals 1 to infinity. And so the idea here is to traditionally the idea has been to follow an approach analogous to what we just discussed for the zeta function. To note that if you define the variable tau, which is it, that as I'm sure you've all seen before, the path integral suddenly looks much more convergent if instead of what we will do now is, if you want to compute the amplitude to go from a certain state on this slice to at t1 to a certain state on this slice at t2, instead of performing the first path integral, an appropriate superposition of e to the I action weighted over all configurations that interpolate between them in real time, we will perform the second path integral. We will sum over all, take the appropriate superposition of e to the I Euclidean action over all configurations that interpolate between those two Euclidean times, and then only at the end of the day we'll make the analytic continuation, replace t tau by it to get back to the answer we wanted in the first place. So the sum, we compute the sum where it converges, and then at the end of the day we use analytic continuation to get the answer in the actual region that we want. So that sounds great, and that procedure more or less succeeds in improving the convergence of most of the field theories constructed of scalars and spinners and vectors that one is interested in, and that one thinks should be sensible. But, you know, famously it fails for gravity. So, you know, if you try the same thing for gravity, you... I neglected to put the equation here. But so that there's this famous fact that if you write the action for gravity, the Einstein-Hilbert action on Euclidean space, then you know, it can be made arbitrarily negative just by taking arbitrarily highly varying conformal factors. So unlike this action, which, you know, the Euclidean action is bounded below here, which is the thing that makes the sum appear more convergent. So the Euclidean action doesn't have that property. It gives all appearances of being horribly divergent, because in addition to the classical solutions, in addition to the sort of saddle point solutions that you sort of hope would dominate the action, all of these solutions with wildly varying conformal factor contribute even more to the path integral. So, with that introduction, let me say a word about Hartle and Hawking's suggestion and what sort of, for the purposes of this talk, are its salient good points and bad points. So, you know, usually one is answering questions of the form, given the state of the system at time t prime, you know, what is the amplitude for such and such a state at time t, and again, you've given the action for the system and the sum over paths prescription, you evaluate that. But there's another sort of question, which is, you know, well, why was the system, you know, that prescription would have worked whatever I told you was the state at time t prime, but why was the state what it was at time t prime? So one answer to that is that because at an even earlier time, t double prime, it was at some other appropriate state that, when evolved by that prescription, gave you back the requisite state at t double prime. And if I ask the question again, PowerPoint permits me one more step in that answering algorithm, but then it runs out. And similarly, in cosmology, you know, that answer seems to run into a dead end. Because, well, first of all, it appears that you can't just keep taking arbitrarily early time slices. It appears that, for all intents and purposes, our universe had some initial time. But then, even if it didn't, even if the universe extended back before the Big Bang, okay, so let's extend this process back to t equals minus infinity. So still, you had to impose some boundary conditions there. And why did you impose the boundary conditions that you did at t equals minus infinity? So, you know, the basic question is, do you need, in addition to the rule, give me the action and then I'll use the Feynman path integral, which answers the sort of evolution questions from one time to another, do I need some additional input to tell me, in the context of cosmology, why the state was what it was at the initial time? So, you know, there, you know, I mean, obviously, in non-cosmological contexts, you can get away with saying, you know, well, the experimenter set it up the way it was at the initial time. But so anyway, it's a matter of taste whether that's a valid solution in cosmology, whether you regard that as a valid solution in cosmology. But I mean, another traditional view would be that, well, we it appears that as we look back, you know, the curvatures, temperatures, and energies are getting higher and higher. You know, maybe some completely new physics that we don't understand determined, you know, string theory or whatever, determined the initial state of the universe, and we're not going to be able to answer the question until we know the physics that pertains to those ultra high curvature regimes. So Hartle and Hawking gave a third answer, which is just that, you know, they took this perspective that so for all other types of theories besides gravity, we go to Euclidean space. Let's do the same thing for gravity. So in Euclidean space, you know, there's this nice property. You all know the surface of a sphere doesn't have any boundaries, or the surface of a donut doesn't have any boundaries, that a Euclidean space, space equipped with a Euclidean metric, can just close off without any additional boundaries. And so, You could you could have the situation where this process has a different type of termination, where the answer to so their proposed description is that you can say let me assume that the answer that I gave to questions of type one, evolution in time, namely action plus path integral plus sum over histories, is also the answer to question of type two, what was the initial state, in the sense that if you don't need any additional information besides the type one information, it seems that the self-consistent thing you're led to is to sum only over those manifolds that have no other boundary, have no past boundary, that you would need to specify additional information at. So if you want to calculate what is the amplitude, what is the wave function of the universe on some spherical section, spatial section of the universe here, you just are instructed to sum over all possible field configurations, including geometries that have no other boundary besides that, besides the one on which you're calculating the wave function. And in my opinion, in principle, that the sort of the spirit of that idea is very beautiful. But for the reason that I mentioned before, that it appears to be a horribly divergent answer, because again, in addition to the nice spherical solution you imagine, there are these solutions with horribly oscillating conformal factor that contribute even more strongly. So at least for that reason, it seems that one has to look for something better. So the question is there some other way to kind of achieve the spirit of that answer, that kind of we don't want anything besides the basic, we don't want to use any input besides the basic sort of idea of finding path integral, that the actions for gravity that we know and love, and maybe a little bit of analytic continuation, but which we already use, it's already run rampant throughout the rest of physics, and so I won't call that too much of an addition. But get a more convergent answer. Okay. So in another context, these recent papers by Witten are kind of devoted to a very similar sort of question. And so let me just describe kind of his formalism for dealing with that. And then how much time have I used? I'm so jet lagged. I don't have my usual. I could be rambling like that, sleeping person. 10 minutes left.
I have a question.
Okay. So consider this integral, and suppose we wanted to, so z is a complex variable. And we want to just find sort of what are the sensible integration contours along which you might integrate this thing. Well, you don't want to integrate it around a closed contour. That might be the first thing you think of, but that's going to be zero because this is an entire function. It has no poles in the complex plane. So you want some contours that sort of go off to infinity. You want some contour that extends from one infinity in the complex plane to another infinity in the complex plane. If you want the integral to converge along those contours, you better take it to go off to infinity in a region where the real part of the argument there, the argument of the exponent there, goes to minus infinity. And so that those are those wedges, that you can see that those are those three wedges in the complex plane, right? Those are the regions in which z cubed, this figure was drawn for, imagine lambda is a positive real number. Then when z cubed is in one of those three wedges in the complex plane, the imaginary part of z cubed is positive, and so I times that is negative, and so you'll get a convergent integral. So it looks like there are three convergent integrals, but in fact they're not independent. Three convergent sort of types of contours, but they're not independent because if you took c1 plus c2 plus c3, again, you could shrink that down to zero. That the sum of those three integrals will be zero. So there's really only two. So the number of convergent contours in this case is equal to the number of critical points of the polynomial 1/3 z cubed minus z. So that's that. That you know, that the ddz of that will be a quadratic polynomial, so it'll have two roots. And so that is not a coincidence. And the reason is that you can associate, the reason is that you can associate each critical point of the argument of the exponent a good contour. And the way you do it is to borrow techniques from Morse theory. And so here, the techniques that I'm about to tell you from Morse theory are the only techniques from Morse theory that I have ever heard of. So if you have any other questions about Morse theory, you're asking the wrong guy. Although I'm learning about it, so maybe by the end of the conference I will be able to answer a few more. But anyway, but let me just describe this little tiny little bit that I know. Okay, so let us regard the real part of the argument. Let's call that H. So let us regard that as a so-called Morse function. So Morse theory is all about you give me a real manifold equipped with a real Riemannian metric and some real value function over that manifold. And then starting from the critical points of that function, so in this case our H, you do various things. You construct cycles and apparently this is a great way to learn about the topology of the manifold itself by studying the critical points and functions over the manifold. But so here, I want to regard this as a Morse function. So let me that should be over a real manifold. So let me take real coordinates x, y on the complex plane, and just introduce some Riemannian metric on the complex plane. Then the so-called flow equation of Morse theory is this thing. Let's call my real coordinates x1 and x2. So xi here in this case, I runs from 1 to 2. And gij is my Riemannian metric, or the inverse thereof. And then s is the flow variable. And now what we want to do to construct an integration cycle is just take all of the So if you start at the critical point, dh dx is 0. And so if you started at the critical point, then that solution will stay, that flow equation says that you'll stay at the critical point for all values of x. You won't flow away from it. So stated another way, if you're anywhere else in the complex plane, if you're anywhere else in this two-dimensional manifold, and you flow as a function of s, then you either will never hit a critical point, or if you hit a critical point, you'll hit it only at s equals plus or minus infinity. Okay? So I want to consider all the places in the complex plane that you can reach such that as you flow backwards to s equals minus infinity, your backwards endpoint is at the critical point. So in other words, all points that you can flow away from the critical point to in the downward direction. So why do I say downward direction? And the answer is because, the key property for our purposes of this flow equation is that as you flow in the positive x direction, that h is monotonically decreasing. So here, this is just the calculation on the bottom line. So the first equality, I just use the chain rule to rewrite dh ds as the product of those two factors. And then I just use the flow equation to replace the second factor. And so, this thing, this final expression that I get is manifestly negative if xij, if gij is a Riemannian metric, by which one of the things I mean is that it is a positive definite metric. Okay, and so you can see that this is what we want, right? We want for each critical point, we start there, and then this flow equation flows us away along a manifold of points where everywhere away from the critical point, the value of h is getting less and less, is running off to minus infinity. So that if we perform the integral over that surface, we will get a finite answer because that minus infinity is appearing in the argument of the exponent. Is this coherent or not coherent? It's not good to ask questions to the audience. Okay, so it should be the other way. I can't describe how jet-lagged and how I'm not up to my usual standards of monitoring myself. So if this is incoherent, I do hope someone will raise their hand. But so if no one does, I will just say that that the reason for introducing all of this formalism is that it can then be generalized quite directly to the case that we actually want to study. which is not this one-dimensional integral, but an infinite dimensional integral, namely the path integral of quantum mechanics. So, in other words, we want to replace, so here I'm going to go through and replace each thing by its analog, okay? Each line by its analog, so rather than getting rid of this whole slide. So, in other words, instead of the original one-dimensional integral, I want to consider the path integral over phase space. Okay, so this is just the ordinary path integral, but written in phase space. And here, my coordinate x denotes both the p's and q's. So it's the coordinate on the phase on the manifold of phase space. And that first thing you're probably more used to seeing is p dq. So you know you're used to this fact that you can rewrite the action instead of the Lagrangian dt, you can rewrite it as p dq minus h dt. Okay. So the first thing, again, the idea is we want to complexify and then choose good contours. So the first thing I want to do is just replace all the x's there by z. So I'm just going to analytically continue the whole expression. Okay, so the one form is analytically continued to a function over the complexified phase space, and the Hamiltonian is analytically continued to a function over a complexified phase space. And so if that's the integral I want to perform, then the appropriate Morse function is the real part of the argument of the exponential. And then the flow equation, so here this is going to be too fast, but the flow equation is replaced by this thing. And there's just no getting around the fact that I'm happy to, that's actually not hard to derive, but I will waste the rest of my time if I derive it for you.
What's omega?
That's a good question. That omega is the imaginary part of the symplectic two form. So basically, here instead of the metric on the complex plane, Gij, that we had in the original form, what we want now is the metric on the space of loops, because the space over which the path integral is being performed, or the space of paths, the space of all maps of paths into the complexified phase. So you just have to figure out what is the natural generalization of that, and then instead of partial h, partial xi, we want sort of a functional derivative of h with respect to xj of, here it was just xj of s, but now in addition to various phase space coordinates, you want to do this flow at every time t, every time along the path. So it's going to be x of so. That is the slightly quicker explanation of why we have this thing. That is why, So I, there's another thing that I was hoping that when we unveiled this a second time it was going to be completely clear. But what I'm calling y here, remember z are just the complexified phase space coordinates. But then again, I want to do my Morse flow over a real manifold. So I've just split the z's into two real coordinates. So the y's are the real coordinates on the complexified phase space. So anyway, to cut to the chase, since I think giving a coherent, I'm just going to waste time and it's not going to get clear. I'm sorry to say. So this is the equation, and so then Witten observes that if you choose, so far. You have some freedom in choosing g, in choosing the metric in the flow equations, because if you look back at our original choosing different g's, slightly different g's, they'll vary exactly what shape the path has, but as long as the path doesn't leave the wedge into an entirely different wedge, you're not going to get a different integral, because you can see that if you deform the contour c, that it still travels from one of those wedges to another. You can easily convince yourself that by Cauchy's theorem, those two wedges will give, those two contours will give the same value for the integral. So what he says is, let's choose g. We will use our freedom to choose g to choose a particularly nice g. So, in particular, he says in the case where the Hamiltonian is zero, you can always choose Gij such that this initial, so in the case where the Hamiltonian is zero, I didn't say this, g is the imaginary part of the analytically continued Hamiltonian, g is also zero. And so there's only the first term there, And then the coefficient gij times omega jk, that's the thing we call I. You can choose that thing to square to minus 1. And if you do that, then that equation becomes conformally invariant. So here, I'm just saying that in a bit more detail. In the case where the Hamiltonian is 0, so capital G is 0, the second term vanishes, I can condense those two factors into what I call curly I, or non-curly I here, and then choose that to square to minus 1. If that thing squares to minus 1, it's called a so-called Hummel's complex structure on the manifold. And this equation, then you can easily check, is conformally invariant in the sense that if I take my two variables t, so t is the actual time along the path, and then s is the flow variable. So whereas before I was starting from a critical point that was just a point in the complex plane, here my critical point is a path. You know, it's a path that solves Hamilton's equations. That's a critical point of the action. So I start from one path, which is my critical point, and then the flow equations takes me to all other possible paths that satisfying that equation that flow to the critical path at s equals minus infinity. And the statement is that is the contour over which, if you perform the path integral, it is guaranteed to converge. But now he's saying, in addition to that, you can make a particularly nice choice of the metric g so that the equation generating that contour is conformally invariant in the sense that if you form the complex variable w, which is t plus is, where t again is the actual dynamical time and s is the sort of Morse flow time, then under any holomorphic mapping, w goes to w tilde. If yi of ts was a solution of that original differential equation, and so will be y twiddle, which is just what you would get by mapping the whole function under that conformal mapping. So it's just in the exact same way that the Cauchy-Riemann equations are conformally invariant. And for the same reason. So then that is the linchpin which allows him to show that the path integral for ordinary quantum mechanics when the Hamiltonian is zero is equivalent to a topological string theory called the topological A-model. I just add that for fun, really. That seems maybe cool, but I actually have no idea what that is. But so I just wanted to mention. So, but then he says, but now in the case where the Hamiltonian is non-zero, so his whole paper focuses on the case where the Hamiltonian is zero, because in the case where the Hamiltonian is non-zero, he says, the whole thing falls apart. Because if you make this choice for I, but you have this extra term, conformal invariance is lost. And that is true. But if you think about it for a little bit more, so this is maybe the one result that is not pure speculation, maybe my one result to report, is just that his formalism is more general than he had realized, just in the sense that actually it does perfectly well apply for an arbitrary Hamiltonian, even if it's not zero. You just have to make the right choice for the metric gij. And the right choice, in that case, is not the one that he makes. But you can see what it is just by remembering that you can always make a conformal transformation, not a conformal transformation, a canonical transformation to new coordinates on phase space such that the Hamiltonian is zero, right? I mean, that is the whole idea of the Hamilton-Jacobi equation. It's solving for the canonical transformation that, so stated another way. So if Q and P are how the coordinate and momenta evolve with time as a function of time and the initial coordinate and momenta, little q and little p, this is a canonical transformation. the transformation from these guys is at every time t canonical. But in these new canonical coordinates, well, of course, for all time, these things stay, they don't evolve with time. So the Hamiltonian in these new canonical coordinates is zero. So what you do, so the correct way to write the conformal invariant flow is you start with a system that has a non-zero Hamiltonian, you make a canonical transformation to new coordinates, which I call y hat, canonical coordinates in which the Hamiltonian is zero, and then in those coordinates, you choose g such that this quantity I squares to minus one. And then if you really want to go back to the more complicated coordinates you started in, that's fine, you can do that. You transform back to those coordinates, but the metric that you take is the metric, you know, just transformed into those coordinates. So it's, in particular, it is a metric that depends not only, in general, on the canonical coordinates on the phase space, but also on explicitly on time. But, you know, okay, so that's the price you pay for working in a more complicated coordinate system than you have to. But so this is maybe the main result, even though it wasn't the main goal that I originally set out to describe to you, but it's the actual thing that was completed. So his formalism is more general, that really is true that any quantum mechanics via this process that you can choose a contour over which to perform the path integral such that the flow equations governing the generation of that contour are conformally invariant, the path integral over the contour is, you know, convergent, and for whatever it's worth, it is equivalent to the topological A model, which for all I know, again, may be something important, but it may also not be, I don't know. So, having described that, I will now proceed to one slide of speculation. I'm out of time. There's only one slide of speculation. So the proposed replacement for the Hartle-Hawking proposal is then basically, you're given an action, and let's say you want to calculate. Let's say you want to calculate the psi of q, whatever q is. But for example, in cosmological context, q might be the 3 metric on some spatial surface. Then you find if you look over the conjugate momenta, you have now a complex phase space of conjugate momenta of basically Hubble constants corresponding to that spatial surface. But for most of those, the action associated to that saddle point will be. You know, in other words, the action associated with the complex classical trajectory that you get from that hij and that kij, that extrinsic curvature, will not be finite. But you just choose the ones that are finite. And then, for each finite one, you do this, you do what appears to be a very natural prescription for getting for generating a path integral contour that is convergent and maybe also nice for other, for maybe also nice, whatever that means, for the reasons that I mentioned. Like it has special mathematical properties. And then you path integrate over each of those, and then you sum over all of the saddle points satisfying that condition. So if you can only do that for, perhaps you cannot find any such finite saddle points for the value of Q, for the value of hij, the value of the 3 metric that you're interested in. Maybe you can only do it, maybe you can only get this to work for complex values of hij. So then you'll be forced at the end of the day to compute for those and then analytically continue to the case you want. But so as you can hear from my description of this is something that I'm trying to work out but have not yet worked out. So if someone in the audience knows a reason why this definitely will not work, I would much prefer to hear sooner rather than later, please. Don't hesitate to come down like a hammer on me. Anyway, thank you for listening.
Questions?
So one of the critical points in your talk was when you explained what the spirit of the Hardle Hawking puzzle was.
I blew that. I agree.
And I
can I try to have another go at it? Yeah.
I was wondering if you could have another go at it.
Okay. Thank you. So, let's say we know the evolution law to get from time t prime to time t.
T is a dark dependent.
Sorry, yes. So there's two types of questions one is interested in. One is, how do you evolve, given the state at one time, how do you evolve to a later time? Given psi of t prime, you know, how do you evolve to, you know, get psi of t? But then there's a second type of question, which is, of all the possible values that psi could have had at this time, and still be consistent with this evolution algorithm, you know, why did it have the particular state that it did? So possible answers to that are, you know, God made it that way. I mean, or this is a serious, you know, that there is some reason beyond what physics will understand about why that is what it is. A second answer is that, you know, string theory made it that way. Where again, these are both, I don't know what the literary device is that's called. God and string theory, I believe I'm using as the same literary device. I don't think it's metonymy. I don't know. Anyway, but a third possibility is something like, maybe the state is what it had to be in order that you didn't need any more information than what I gave you in part one. That the answer the state is whatever it is, so that the answer to question two is determined by the same information that answers question one. So the Hardle-Hawking what Hardle-Hawking noticed is that Since we're already in the business of analytically continuing everything else to Euclidean space in order to get more convergent integrals, let's do the same thing for the gravitational field. Well, then a nice possibility arises, which is that instead of tracing the state here back to some previous boundary, well, Euclidean spaces can just close off so that they don't have any additional boundary. And so then the statement would be you perform this sum over all possible paths, but not between some prior boundary and the boundary that you're interested in, but just all possible paths that have no other boundary, that require no additional information. Just paths that match the data that you're trying to compute the wave function for on the boundary you're interested in, but require no other boundary. That's a perfectly consistent, you know, sort of it's the most radically economical answer to the question. It doesn't take new physics, it doesn't take new, it just says that the path integral is over the only thing that it can be, so that it self-consistently doesn't require any additional information. So that's sort of the spirit. So again, then my statement was that the spirit of that answer is very beautiful, but the actual answer appears to be horribly divergent. The path integral that you compute is horribly divergent. So the question is, can you get the spirit without the divergence?
So, on the same topic, you seem to be asking more questions about the past than you are about the future. I mean, this equation one doesn't tell you what the future state is going to be, it just tells you what the probabilities of the future state are going to be.
This is time. I think the whole prescription is time symmetric. I mean,
well, the thing about equation one, you say the path integral will give you the answer. Well, it doesn't. It just tells you the probability of each outcome. So, you're not asking why is it that this actual state is observed. You're asking why is it that there's a probability distribution, but you're asking a different question about the initial state.
Nope. I'm saying for, no, I'm calculating a wave function on this initial state. I'm saying for example, let's take, cosmologists like to talk for simplicity about mini superspace, where the only degree of freedom, where everything is clearly homogeneous, and the only degree of freedom in the problem is, overall size of a closed universe at some particular time, and the value of its, expansion. But those, but you can't specify those simultaneously. You're all not with it. So for example, we could calculate, if we wanted to calculate the wave function of the universe as a function of A, the radius of the three sphere at that time, then for every value of A, you can perform the path integral over all field configurations that match that value of A. That's the number you get for psi of A, but then for psi of A twiddle, or a different value of A, you re-perform it, you get a different number. So you get a wave function that has a different value for every value of A that you specify. You're still free to, in other words, you're still free. You're asking, you're trying to compute what is the amplitude for all possible configurations on this surface? And the answer is, for any individual configuration, you calculate the number associated to that configuration by summing over all four configurations that have no other boundary and that match that specified three data.
Okay, so you're looking for the probability distribution on both the
wave function, the amplitude.
I'm getting this is. Is that answering my own question? Wait, what are you asking?
So I mean, you're using amplitude and wave function.
I was saying amplitude when I think about the value of the wave function for some particular configuration, and then you're calculating when I say wave function, I mean an amplitude for all possible configurations. And okay. for each possible configuration, there's a different amplitude. By amplitude, I mean complex number.
Okay.
And so, by wave function, I mean, map to the complex numbers from some data.
Okay, so you're happy just knowing all the amplitudes, rather than knowing the actual initial state or actual final state, as long as you know all the amplitudes.
Oh yeah, you mean that's right. When I say the initial state, I mean the initial quantum state, the wave function. I'm not even sure initial is the right word, because there's this famous problem of time in the wave function. But yes, for any possible three geometry, what is the probability that you are living in?
Just another quick basic question. Am I right believing that there's a connection between the Hadamard-Hawking approach and the Wild-Weil equation?
I think you can, that's right. So you can derive, if you do the path integral, this is something I personally have not done, but I'm almost certain that it is. Has anyone done this? You can, if you say the path integral, if you demand that the e to the I Einstein-Hilbert action path integrated between if I specify a certain initial configuration at time t1 and another configuration at time t2 and say the path integral is over e to the I Einstein-Hilbert action for all possible configurations and interpolate, then that leads to the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. But this is an additional, but there's...
Yeah, I mean, what was the logical connection? You said, because you solve the Wheeler-DeWitt equation,
I think the Wheeler-DeWitt equation follows from this path integral prescription in the same way that the Schrodinger equation follows from the normal path integral prescription. So in other words, the Wheeler-DeWitt equation is the Schrodinger equation. But their point is that they're not just deriving the Schrodinger equation, they're also telling you what state. They're not leaving, the Schrodinger equation will evolve any state for you, but they're choosing boundary conditions that pick out a particular state.
Well, that's what the Wheeler-DeWitt equation does.
They actually compute a unique, well, that's what the Wheeler, no. What? But there are a huge number of there are a huge number of wave functions that satisfy that. Any yeah. So they're actually calculating a unique wave function. The set of all wave functions in the universe that satisfy the Wheeler-DeWitt equation is infinite dimensional.
Okay, thank the speaker again.